When most people visit the Anglican shrine of Our Lady in Walsingham, they fail to notice a small block of blue-grey stone mounted above the holy water stoop by the south door to the holy house. Simply marked Glastonbury, this fragment of Somerset blue lias comes from the Lady Chapel at Glastonbury Abbey. Arguably one of the oldest, if not the oldest, Marian shrine in the British Isles, Glastonbury's gaunt ruins barely hint at this shrine's antiquity and dignity or its past glories. Glastonbury, for those of you that don't know, is located in central Somerset at the end of a long peninsula of land which juts out into the Somerset Levels. The town of Glastonbury nestles between four hills: Wirral Hill, Edmund Hill, Chalice Hill and the Tor. And at the town centre lies the Abbey Precinct. Here can be found the ruins of the medieval abbey, but most importantly the gaunt shell of the Church of St Mary of Glastonbury, commonly called the Lady Chapel or St Joseph's Chapel, but this is to anticipate. And just so you can all see where we are about here this morning. This is where St Mary's Church is. This is the Abbey Precinct, as you can see, and here we have the ruins of the great Church of St Peter and St Paul, and this is the Lady Chapel or the Church of St Mary of Glastonbury at its west end. The origins of the cultus of Our Lady at Glastonbury are obscure, and our first glimpses are found in the Abbey's Anglo-Saxon charters. The earliest such charter, widely accepted as authentic, albeit only extant in a 10th century copy, is a land grant dated 681 AD. This was given by the West Saxon sub-king Baldred to the Church of Blessed Mary and Blessed Patrick at Glastonbury, although the addition of St Patrick to the dedication may be a later addition. A charter of King Ine of Wessex, witnessed by St Aldhelm just over 20 years later in 704, described this church as the wooden church, the Ligna Basilica, while an addition to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle records that Ine built the first stone minster church at Glastonbury, which was dedicated to St Peter and St Paul. In the centuries that followed, the wooden church started to be called the Old Church, or Old Church, the Vetusta Ecclesia. More formally, it was known as the Church of St Mary of Glastonbury, and it was this building which initially constituted the focus of the Virgin's cultus. Having established that there was seemingly a church dedicated to St Mary in Glastonbury by the late 7th century, as the Anglo-Saxon scholar Mary Clayton has observed, this early dedication to the Virgin is something of an anomaly, we can turn to the earliest surviving written account of Glastonbury's origins. This is to be found in the first Vita Dunstane, the first life of St Dunstan. Written within a year or two either side of the first millennium, we only know the Vita's author by the initial B, but it seems likely that B knew St Dunstan personally. The relevant passage regarding the origins of the old church appears close to the beginning of the Vita. B states, "For it was in this island that by God's guidance the first novices of the Catholic law discovered an ancient church, not built or dedicated in the memory of man. Later, the builder of the heavens himself revealed by many miraculous and supernatural happenings that it was consecrated to him and his holy mother Mary. To this church they added a second, building it of stone, and the bishops dedicated it to Christ and his apostle St Peter." Thus, from the latter 10th century, Glastonbury was believed to have a special relationship with Christ and his mother. But of the appearance of this ancient church of St Mary, we know little. Apart from the brief description of a wooden building sheathed in lead recorded by the chronicler William of Malmesbury in his De Antiquitate Glastoni Ecclesiae and the possible depiction of the old church on the abbey's first common seal, little comment can be made. Even its precise dimensions are in doubt. The liturgical arrangements of its interior are likewise lost to us, although it is known to have contained a principal altar packed with relics, three tomb shrines to St Indract, St Patrick and St Gildas, a remarkable pavement and a venerable image of the Virgin. After the conquest of England in 1066, Glastonbury was ruled by a succession of Norman ecclesiastics, the greatest of whom was Henry of Blois, abbot of Glastonbury from 1126 to 1171. One of Glastonbury's greatest abbots and a man known for his energetic building schemes, Blois respected the old church's integrity. Seemingly, it was deemed too sacred to be reconstructed. Indeed, through Abbot Blois' inspiration, the brothers observed all the principal festivals of St. Mary, Dei Genetrix, with much more than the accustomed devotion and solemnity, and Blois personally endowed the upkeep of a candle perpetually burning before the Virgin Mary statue in the old church. We should also observe that the earliest fair granted to the abbey by Henry I in the year of Blois' abbacy, 1126-1127, began on the 8th of September, the Nativity of the Blessed Virgin. Barely 50 years after William of Malmesbury penned his brief description of the old church, Glastonbury Abbey suffered its only major disaster, the Great Fire of 1184. Devastating the entire monastery, it left only a single chamber, a chapel, and a bell tower undamaged. It is not known how or where the fire started, but the Glastonbury community believed that it was due to the desecration of the old church, and its consequences were far-reaching. Fortunately for the monks, King Henry II came to their aid, and with royal patronage, reconstruction was swift. The king's site manager at Glastonbury, Ralph Fitzstephen, finished St Mary's Church on the spot where the old church had originally stood, using squared stones and the most attractive workmanship, and he spared nothing in its ornamentation. That this construction was undertaken in parallel to the building of the presbytery of the new great church of St Peter and St Paul is exceptional, and it clearly signals the importance of the old church and the Marian cultus to the Glastonbury community. This new church, St Mary, which also doubled as the abbey's Lady Chapel, is the roofless building which still stands at the west end of the abbey ruins today. Consecrated by Reginald, Bishop of Bath, just 2 years after the fire, the new chapel was built in a deliberately old-fashioned style to echo the antiquity of the old church it replaced. The interior of the new church of St Mary was extravagantly painted with rare and costly pigments and lit with richly coloured glass. Pilgrims would have been in no doubt that they were on holy ground. Unsurprisingly, the fire prompted a profound shift in the abbey's spiritual geography. Before 1184, the old church had been the abbey's ancient sacred centre, while the Norman Abbey Church to the east, with its tombs and memorials, had been a clear visual statement of the monastery's dignity and power. But in the fire, all this was lost. The oldest church in the land, built by the first British Christians and dedicated to the Virgin, had perished. A new focus had to be found, as Glastonbury's ancient origins could no longer be taken for granted. Now, they had to be clearly emphasised. After all, a pilgrim arriving at the Abbey after 1184 would have found a building site where almost everything was new. It is little surprise, therefore, that an ancient wooden statue of the Virgin, the only object from the old church which survived the fire intact, suddenly took on a profound new significance. Although we can't be wholly certain, it seems likely that the seated Virgin, shown on the abbey's 13th century seal, is a depiction of this wooden image. According to a passage later inserted in William of Malmesbury's De Antiquitate, this statue was not touched, not even the veil that hung from its head, by the great fire that surrounded the altar and consumed the cloth and all the ornaments on it. Yet because of the fire's heat blisters, like those on a living man, arose on its face and remained visible for a long time to all who looked, testifying to a divine miracle. The 14th century chronicler, John of Glastonbury, later repeated this story in his Chronica Civi Antiquitatis Glastoniensis Ecclesiae, but added the following comment, noting that the blisters on the statue's face were a worthy demonstration of the miracle that fire could not touch the image of her who remained ever virgin in body and mind, and who knew no lust for the flesh. Thus the Holy Mother of God herself defended her image from fire and showed that she is able, with the greatest of ease, to free those who serve her from the fires of hell. This ancient statue thus became a tangible link, and perhaps the only direct visual link, in the new church of St Mary, the Lady Chapel, to Glastonbury's lost past. Granting a direct sense of continuity between the two buildings, the statue and its miraculous survival stood as incontrovertible proof that Glastonbury's patron, St Mary the Virgin, watched over the community and regarded it as her own. In the aftermath of the Great Fire of 1184, St Mary's importance to the abbey grew enormously. But due to time constraints here this morning, we are only able to touch on a few of the major points which contributed to the development of Marian devotion at Glastonbury. Numerous texts were composed which stressed the Virgin's special relationship with the abbey, the most important of which was arguably the great privilege of King Henry II. Granted not long after the fire, its author claimed that of all the places in the Kingdom of England, the Virgin had chosen Glastonbury, especially for herself. While the exact meaning of this enigmatic statement is left unexplained, it may imply that the miraculous survival of St. Mary's statue in the Great Fire was interpreted by the monastic audience as a mark of particular favour. It was less than a decade after the Great Fire when perhaps the single most important event in Glastonbury's history transpired, the discovery of the bodies of King Arthur and Queen Guinevere. But Arthur himself did not significantly impact upon the Virgin's cultus, other than reinforce St. Mary's continued importance at the Abbey. Both Geoffrey of Monmouth and Nennius before him claimed that Arthur fought with an image of the Virgin on his shield, which forced him to think perpetually of her. Thus, when Arthur's marrying credentials were combined with the Abbey's, it is perhaps not surprising that it was later claimed that the King had attended a mystical mass just outside Glastonbury at Beckery, at which not only were both Christ and Our Lady present, but after which the Virgin personally presented Arthur with a rock crystal cross as a memento of the occasion. Indeed, the Abbey affirmed that this relic was preserved in its treasury, and throughout the Middle Ages, the Virgin's cross was regularly carried in procession through the Great Church on Wednesdays and Fridays in Lent. The crystal cross was seemingly so well regarded that from the beginning of the 15th century, both the Virgin and her cross were depicted on the Abbey's official shield of arms. In the century which followed, the Abbey grew and prospered, helped by a succession of able and prudent abbots. One of the most powerful monastic foundations in England, Glastonbury had consolidated its huge estates, enjoyed immense wealth, received numerous privileges, was associated with many prominent saints, and claimed to be the most ancient Christian foundation in the realm. Then, quite unexpectedly, during the abbacy of Adam of Sodbury, in other words, between 1323 and 1334, a miraculous event occurred in the Lady Chapel. Once, while the convent of Glastonbury was chanting the antiphon Salve Regina in devotion to God and Blessed Mary, the glorious Virgin's image, which stood at the altar, moved like a living lady. While a whole crowd of secular people looked on, and while the monks watched as well, she clapped for the child she held in her lap, now putting her hand to his face, now drawing it back in reverence. Nor did she cease these movements until the choir had haltingly sung through the whole antiphon. This miracle was first recorded by the Glastonbury monk Edmund Stoughton in his lost book, De Nominibus Jesu et Maria, The Name of Jesus and Mary, which he addressed to Pope John XXIII, 1316 to 1334. Although we only know of Stoughton's book and the account of the miracle it contained from a later reference, works such as his indicate that Glastonbury's monks had a lively enthusiasm for the Virgin's cult, and that they zealously promulgated it at the very highest levels beyond the confines of their monastery. It seems that this miracle deeply affected Abbot Sodbury, for it was later recorded that he not only adorned the high altar of the Abbey Church with a large statue of the Mother of God and a magnificent tabernacle, which may be the standing image of the Virgin depicted on the Abbey's 14th century seal, but in February 1333, he also instituted a body of 8 secular priests whose primary purpose was to minister daily in the Lady Chapel and to serve in the charnel chapel of St. Michael, which stood at the south side of the old cemetery. The most important development in the devotional life of the Abbey since the reordering after the Great Fire of 1184, Abbot Sodbury's initiative seems likely to have been a direct result of increased pilgrim traffic to the Lady Chapel in the wake of the miracle of the moving statue. Later, collectively known as the Clerks of Our Lady, these priests' daily routine mirrored the canonical hours of the monk's divine office. In addition to observing this formal timetable of prayer, the clerks were also expected to celebrate their own masses, the office for the dead, and to join the monastic community in worship on certain festivals. Provided with a house and garden close to the Lady Chapel and their own distinctive vesture, by the suppression in 1539, there were seemingly 12 clerks, doubtless intentionally mirroring St. Joseph of Arimathea's 12 legendary companions. Acting almost like a monastery within a monastery, these priests served in a church in which it was believed that the Virgin, in a very tangible way, had made evident her continued support for Glastonbury. In the final decades of the 14th century, Abbot John Chinnock thoroughly restored the Lady Chapel. During this restoration, Chinnock clothed the image, the ancient miraculous statue of St. Mary, as befitted it, adorning it with gold and precious stones, and enclosing many relics within it. The appearance engendered by the image's garnishing with precious materials clearly heightened its profile in the Lady Chapel, stressing its status as the building's principal devotional aid and visual focus. To the medieval mind, the gold and gems used to adorn the image served as material analogues of the Virgin's spiritual glorification. Abbot Chinnock's enclosure of holy relics within the image is also noteworthy. A not uncommon practice throughout the Middle Ages, the relics, unseen by human eyes, further guaranteed the holiness and authenticity of the statue and the altar which it adorned. More than this, like the Lady Chapel it inhabited, the image of the Virgin became simultaneously relic and reliquary, the vessel of salvation. As God himself had been enclosed in the Virgin's womb, so the relics of the saints were enclosed in an image of Our Lady the Virgin, symbolic of the Church enclosing and sheltering the saints, just as the Lady Chapel enclosed and sheltered the faithful, a complex, multi-layered symbolism which would not have been lost on her monastic audience, even if not fully appreciated by the average pilgrim. Sadly, we know little of the presentation of the cultus and its internal modus operandi. No service books, collections of miracles, or lists of offerings survive, and there is no shrine customary to provide details about the ritual and ceremonial surrounding the cult. The evidence of the few surviving personal seals from the abbey demonstrate that the community had an active devotion to their patron, and we know that the Lady Chapel had its own choir consisting of 10 clerks, 10 boys, and an organist. As no account books survive, we do not know what the annual offerings consisted, although in 1539, the sacristan's revenue of £311, 12 shillings and sixpence, was drawn from a variety of sources, including offerings in the old church. Aside from a set of prayer beads made out of pure gold, gifted to the Lady Chapel by Queen Philippa, the wife of Edward III, sometime after the royal visit to the monastery in 1331, we know of no other gifts, but the architectural development of the Lady Chapel can be reconstructed with some certainty, although it is too complex to be considered here. It was in the atmosphere of dynamism and creativity that characterised the abbacy of Glastonbury's penultimate abbot, Richard Bere, at the beginning of the 16th century, that the last medieval source addressing Glastonbury's sacred origins, the Life of St. Joseph of Arimathea, was written. Presumably commissioned by Abbot Bere, it was printed in London by Richard Pinson in 1520. Although the life's author remains anonymous, he is thought to have been a Glastonbury monk. A simple pamphlet meant for easy sale and distribution, its production clearly illustrates Glastonbury's self-promotion as both the birthplace of English Christianity and as an important Marian pilgrimage centre. The majority of the poem is based on the familiar version of St. Joseph of Arimathea's life, taken from the narrative in John of Glastonbury's Chronicler, and it does not concern us. Having travelled from the Holy Land to Britain, St. Joseph and his companions eventually settle in Avalon, now called Glastonbury, which was given to them by the local pagan ruler Arivagus. What they then did is summarised in two verses of enormous importance to both the development of the abbey's foundation legend and to perceptions of Glastonbury as England's premier holy site. Although the life was written to emphasise St. Joseph's role as the monastery's founder and extol his intercessory potency at the abbey, these two verses clearly signal not only the close connection between St. Joseph of Arimathea and the Virgin, but more importantly, a shift in emphasis in the presentation of St. Mary's cult at the abbey. Although difficult to decipher, they repay close examination. There Joseph lived with other hermits 12, that were the chief of all the company, but Joseph was the chief himself. There led they a holy life and ghostly, till at last, Jesu the mighty, he sent to Joseph the angel Gabriel, which bade him, as the writing doth specify, of Our Lady's Assumption to build a chapel. So Joseph did as the angel him bade, and wrought there an image of Our Lady, for to serve her great devotion he had. And at that same image is yet at Glastonbury, in the same church. There ye may see it, for it was the first, as I understand, that ever was seen in this country, for Joseph it made with his own hand. Not only is The Life's author clearly reasserting Glastonbury's preeminence as the earliest and most important shrine to Our Lady in the British Isles, but just as significantly, the statue of St. Mary is now presented as a type of image known in Greek as archeropotes, i.e. not made by ordinary human hands. Such images were extremely uncommon in the medieval world and were held in high esteem. Believed to have been created miraculously or to have been painted or carved from life, often by St. Luke the Evangelist or someone close to Christ, they were regarded as sacred from their very creation. They became relics in their own right, quite aside from any later miraculous occurrences associated with them. In this respect, Glastonbury's ancient statue of St. Mary took on a whole new dimension. Claimed to have been carved at angelic prompting by St. Joseph himself, who not only knew the Virgin in life, but was also considered Christ's step-uncle, at a stroke, Glastonbury's statue was seen to transcend all other images of St. Mary in England. It thus became a unique object of pilgrimage, which underlied the Abbey's sanctity. The Life's author also links the existing Lady Chapel with Joseph's first church by stating that they were the same church. He also notes that the Lady Chapel was dedicated to the Assumption of Our Lady, thereby associating both the chapel and the image with what had become the most important Marian feast of the High Middle Ages. At a stroke, this promoted Glastonbury's Lady Chapel into the feast's primary devotional locus in England. If you wish to celebrate Our Lady's Assumption, then you should do it at Glastonbury. This Life of St. Joseph represents the final flowering of the Catholic legend of Glastonbury and our last glimpse of the cultus of Our Lady before the disillusion overtook the Abbey. With the injunctions against devotional images promulgated in 1536 and 1538, it is likely that the image of Our Lady of Glastonbury was initially removed from the Lady Chapel and hidden from view, as were all the shrines in Glastonbury's great church. We have no idea how the injunctions impacted the life of the cultus, but presumably their impact was severe, if not terminal. The image perhaps escaped the humiliation of public burning that the more famous Marian images from Walsingham and Ipswich endured at Chelsea in July 1538, but the ultimate fate of Glastonbury's wonder-working statue is unknown. While it may have been stripped of its gold and jewels in 1538 during the campaign against shrines, alternatively, it may have been included amongst those items sent to London to be broken up after the dissolution of the Abbey in November 1539. It is not beyond the bounds of possibility, however, that the image may have been deliberately concealed or smuggled out of the country. At Glastonbury, church plate is known to have been hidden from the King's commissioners, albeit not particularly successfully. On November the 14th, 1539, Richard Whiting, the last abbot of Glastonbury, was subjected to a show trial at the Bishop's Palace in Wells. Found guilty of treason, the following day the abbot was taken to Glastonbury, where he and two of his monks were hanged, drawn and quartered on the summit of Glastonbury Tor. With Whiting's martyrdom, over 1,000 years of monastic history abruptly came to an end. But with the accession of Edward VI's sister, Mary Tudor, in 1553, Catholicism was reintroduced in England. The new queen also encouraged a return to the religious life by refounding a number of monasteries, the most important of which was the Royal Abbey of Westminster. Four former Glastonbury monks had not forgotten their old home, and in 1554 they petitioned the Lord Chamberlain for the restoration of Glastonbury Abbey to the Benedictine order, on the grounds of its being a house of such antiquity and of fame throughout all Christendom, first begun by St. Joseph of Arimathea, who took down the dead body of our Saviour Christ from the cross and lieth buried in Glastonbury. But despite the best of intentions, the scheme was still born, and with the accession of Elizabeth I, any last hope of re-establishing Glastonbury was dashed, and demolition gradually overtook the monastic complex. Over 1,000 years of continuous worship, history and tradition had finally and irretrievably been brought to an end, and with it, not only the cultus of Our Lady of Glastonbury, but its very memory. But despite the Abbey's destruction, Glastonbury re-emerged to play a minor but essential role in England's new patriotic Protestant foundation myth. Now little more than a romantic ruin, it was St. Joseph of Arimathea's coming to Glastonbury that mattered, rather than what he did when he got there. The messenger had replaced the message. Protestants were not interested in Mary's role in Glastonbury Foundation or Marian devotion, while Catholics had more pressing matters with which to concern themselves than a defunct cultus in a suppressed monastery. In result, almost 280 years were to pass before Our Lady of Glastonbury was finally rediscovered. In 1826, an Anglican clergyman by the name of the Reverend Richard Warner published the first modern history of Glastonbury. Entitled An History of the Abbey of Glaston, it was through Warner's auspices that Glastonbury's ancient Marian tradition again saw the light of day. Although typical of his profession and generation, wearing his prejudice against popish monkery on his sleeve, Warner nonetheless scoured medieval sources and came to recognise that the Shrine of the Blessed Virgin was the first of the inducements to a pilgrimage that medieval Glastonbury offered the faithful. Displaying a profound misunderstanding of the nature of Marian veneration, as well as inaccuracy about the location and focus of her medieval cultus at the Abbey, he characterised it with the following wildly romantic description. To her, the great church was dedicated, and to her was dedicated the larger proportion of the worship performed within its walls. Her altar, preeminent in holiness, as in magnitude, shone with choicest treasures, blazed with the greatest flood of light, and rolled through the fane the rich cloud of choicest incense. To her honour, all the mechanical arts which the monks practised were tributary, and on her effigies more especially were bestowed their chief labour, skill, and cost. Numerous were the images of the Blessed Virgin which glittered in the various parts of the venerable pile. Despite such lyricism, it is interesting to observe that in Warner's history, the Virgin has been excised altogether from the Abbey's arms. It was not until some four decades later that a Roman Catholic formally recognised Glastonbury's ancient Marian credentials. James Spencer Northcote, the president of St Mary's College, Oscott, published Celebrated Sanctuaries of the Madonna in 1868. Having addressed the major European Marian shrines, he went on to observe, as every reader will be aware, the most ancient Christian temple ever erected in this island is held by constant and venerable tradition to have been that little church of wreathed twigs which St. Joseph of Arimathea is said to have constructed and which, according to ancient legends, was believed to have been consecrated by our Lord himself in honour of his blessed mother. Whoever may have been the real founder of this church, it was certainly dedicated to the Blessed Virgin. However, it was seemingly the Stonyhurst alumnus, Edmund Waterton, author of Pietas Mariana Britannica, published in 1879, that finally reawakened English Catholics to Glastonbury's Marian heritage. Although he principally focused his attention on Walsingham, Waterton's scrutiny of medieval sources led him to conclude that Glastonbury is the most ancient and venerable sanctuary to Our Lady in England, and that King Arthur went to Glastonbury that he might die under the protection of Our Lady. Waterton even went as far as to claim that Glastonbury's foundation in honour of Our Lady is anterior to that of Santa Maria in Trastevere in Rome. From Waterton, then, perhaps arose the 20th century claim, articulated most notably by the Arthurian scholar Geoffrey Ashe, that Glastonbury may have been the earliest foundation dedicated to the Blessed Virgin Mary, or at least her older shrine, north of the Alps. But despite this growing awareness of Glastonbury's Marian history, it was not until the final decades of the 19th century that the Roman Catholic and Anglican churches became actively involved in Glastonbury. In 1895, the last abbot of Glastonbury, Richard Whiting, and two of his companions were beatified by Pope Leo XIII. The beatifications were marked by a national pilgrimage to Glastonbury in September the same year. Organised by Downside Abbey and the Catholic Truth Society, it was the first official Roman Catholic pilgrimage to visit Glastonbury for 3.5 centuries. While Our Lady was, of course, acknowledged, at the devotional heart of the pilgrimage stood the martyrs, and the day culminated with the ascent of Glastonbury Tor to the place where Whiting and his companions died. For obvious reasons, the abbey ruins did not feature on the itinerary. The following year, the Roman Catholic missionaries of the Sacred Heart, originally a French order, arrived in town, where they founded an apostolic school at Chalice Well. Building Glastonbury's first Catholic chapel since the Reformation, it was dedicated to Our Lady of the Sacred Heart and housed what was probably the first image of the Virgin seen on public display in the town since the Dissolution. But the Marian tone of the missionaries' devotion spoke to their own origins rather than Glastonbury's. Just 12 months after the arrival of the MSC Fathers, the first Anglican pilgrimage to Glastonbury was arranged. marking the end of the Lambeth Conference for 1897, 130 Anglican bishops made their way to Glastonbury, where they attended evensong in the Abbey ruins, with the Archbishop of Canterbury presiding. Although the Abbey was the focus for this remarkable gathering, there was no Marian element to the proceedings. Just 10 years later, the Abbey ruins were sold, and in 1908, the remains of Glastonbury Abbey were vested in a charitable trust, which still administers the site today. It was not until the second quarter of the 20th century, however, that Our Lady gained a higher profile in Glastonbury's churches. The Reverend Lionel Smithet Lewis, Anglican vicar of St John's Church on the High Street, ministered in Glastonbury from 1921 to 1950. Best known for his too enthusiastic rather than academically rigorous treatments of the Glastonbury traditions, St Joseph of Arimathea at Glastonbury and Glastonbury Her Saints, Lewis was an unabashed supporter of Glastonbury's legendary Christian past, and in particular the pious 19th century fable of a visit by the child Christ with his step-uncle, St Joseph of Arimathea. Throughout his time as vicar, Lewis collected miscellaneous relics he believed associated with the medieval abbey, assembling them in the north transept of the parish church as a quasi-shrine to Glastonbury's founder. More conventionally, he also re-established a lady chapel to the north of the principal altar in the parish church, which persists to this day. But despite his pronounced high church leanings, Lewis seems not to have been interested in Marian devotion, or even been aware of Glastonbury's ancient Marian past. After he retired to Farnham in 1950, Lewis published two papers in Ave, the organ of the Society of Mary, in which he articulated the extraordinary view that Glastonbury was special, not because of its dedication, early foundation, or associations with Joseph of Arimathea, but because it was the burial place of Our Lady. Unsurprisingly, Lewis's ideas found little support. While Lewis presided over the town's Anglican needs, Glastonbury's first post-Reformation Roman Catholic church opened in 1926. Dedicated simply to St Mary, the first parish priest, Father Francis Burdett, a Jesuit by training, would have preferred the title Our Lady St Mary of Glastonbury, but his bishop, William Lee, declined. While a traditional image of the Virgin graced the new church's interior, Father Burdett commissioned a modern Madonna and Child from the sculptor Eric Gill in 1928 to adorn the church's east-facing gable. When the present Catholic church was erected in 1939-1940, Eric Gill's Madonna and Child was found to be superfluous to requirements, and so it was placed in the garden of the Convent of the Sisters of Charity of St Louis, which then stood next door to the parish church, where it was soon forgotten. It was not until after the war that the shared devotion and collaborative vision of Bishop Bruderham of Clifton and Glastonbury's then parish priest, Father O'Brien, resulted in the formal restoration of the Shrine of Our Lady of Glastonbury. While we might have expected the Abbey's medieval chronicles to have supplied the inspiration, the cataclysm seems rather to have been Pius XII's papal encyclical, The Radiant Crown, that proclaimed 1954 a Marian year to commemorate the centenary of the definition of the dogma of the Immaculate Conception. This encyclical urged that 1954 should witness an adequate celebration in every diocese and every parish in Our Lady's honour. The time had clearly come for a Marian revival in Glastonbury. Thus, the following year, the ancient shrine of Our Lady of Glastonbury was canonically restored in the name of the Holy See. Before the formal inauguration, a new image of Our Lady was commissioned. Carved by a leading Catholic sculptor, P.L. Clark, sometime president of the Guild of Catholic Artists, this wooden statue of Our Lady holds a flowering rod in one hand and presents the Christ child to the world with the other. Interestingly, this image is not modelled on the seated Romanesque Virgin shown on the Abbey's 13th century seal, which almost certainly depicts the ancient miraculous statue of St Mary, but is instead a copy of the depiction of the Virgin which appears on the Abbey's 14th century seal. Seemingly unaware of the importance of the seated figure of Our Lady, the standing image of the Virgin seems to have been chosen for aesthetic reasons rather than historical sentiment. In July 1955, Our Lady's ancient shrine, destroyed at the suppression of Glastonbury Abbey, was formally restored by canon law. A crowd of some 18,000 pilgrims witnessed the apostolic delegate, Archbishop Gerald O'Hara, acting on behalf of the Holy See, bless the newly carved statue before it was processed to the present Roman Catholic Church of St Mary on Magdalen Street, where it was initially installed against the column to the liturgical south of the sanctuary. 10 years later, on the 4th of July 1965, the image was formally crowned during the first pontifical mass held in the Abbey grounds since the Reformation, within sight of the Lady Chapel that had housed the miraculous predecessor. A mark of special honour, the crown which the apostolic delegate to Great Britain, Archbishop Ignio Cardinale, placed on the image's head was made from gold jewellery presented by the congregation of St Mary's Church. Crowned in the Abbey ruins, in the presence of an ecumenical gathering of over 20,000 people, it is said to have been the biggest gathering of pilgrims at Glastonbury Abbey since Easter 1278, when King Edward I and Queen Eleanor reburied the bones of King Arthur and Queen Guinevere before the high altar of the Great Church. Although plans were put in hand to build a new shrine chapel at St Mary's Parish Church to house the Virgin's image, the vision, sadly, did not come to fruition. Not long after the coronation in 1965, the image of Our Lady of Glastonbury was translated to its present location in the Roman Catholic Parish Church behind its principal altar. Flanked on either side with a newly commissioned tapestry depicting a number of saints associated with Glastonbury, the image of the Virgin stands on a pillar and is sheltered by a canopy. Inserted into this pillar is a piece of Dalton limestone from the Abbey ruins, donated to the church by the Abbey trustees. Inscribed with the words Jesu Maria, Jesus Mary, it is a copy of the inscription which can still be seen carved in Lombardic capitals on the south exterior wall of the Abbey's ruined Lady Chapel, an inscription that emphasises the Christian message and which acts as a visible connection between the ancient and modern shrines. This image of Our Lady of Glastonbury still visits the Abbey ruins each year during the Diocese of Clifton's annual pilgrimage to the town. There is a final episode in this story, and it concerns the Madonna and Child by Eric Gill and the Glastonbury Abbey trustees' recognition of Glastonbury Abbey's Marian past. Having been placed in St Louis Convent Garden, Gill's image of the Virgin and Child remained there for some time until it was transferred to a grave in Glastonbury's Municipal Cemetery. After more than 40 years resting in obscurity, the image was finally recognised as a major sculptural work, and conservation was arranged by Father Paul Sankey of St Mary's Catholic Church in consultation with the Glastonbury and Chartham Burial Board. After spending time in Bristol in the protective care of the Bishop of Clifton, the statue was returned to Glastonbury for public display. It was unveiled on the 25th of March, the Feast of the Annunciation 2011, and it now stands in a place of honour in the centre of Glastonbury Abbey's museum. And so this statue of the Madonna and Child not only acts as a bridge, bringing the past into the present by acknowledging a previously forgotten chapter in the Abbey's spiritual history, but it also reminds all who look on it of the heart of the Christian mystery itself. Thank you.